Welcome to Luckus Fuckus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. And today, once again, we're live from the KBOO station. On July 27th, Governor Kate Brown signed Oregon's 100% clean energy bill into law. This law requires Oregon energy companies to provide their customers with 100% clean electricity by 2040, an ambitious deadline matched only by the state of New York. This comes as one of several bills passed during Oregon's 2021 legislative session that achieve climate and social justice goals that have eluded previous legislative sessions. Today we talk with Oregon State Representative Con Pham, who played a leading role in shepherding this progressive legislation through the Oregon House. Con is a longtime community advocate and social justice activist who was elected in 2020 as state representative for House District 46. Con, welcome back to Luckus Fuckus.
Thanks for having me, Barbara.
Well, the last time we talked, I believe you were a community activist and environmental activist for that matter. So how does it feel now? What's the difference between your past activism work and now that you're in the state legislature?
You know, it feels really incredible. I think that to be able to work with the very same partners that I've been working with for years, but to be able to have more access on the inside, to be able to have really to have an effective inside-outside strategy, I think we are going to need to do more collaborations like this. I'm just really ecstatic about all that we were able to achieve this session, thanks to really powerful community organizing across the state, particularly from frontline communities who've not often had the chance to really shape policy to make sure that environmental justice and frontline voices are really centered.
And actually groups that are not probably that used to having their own representatives in as elected officials.
Well, I actually came in with a bunch of first years who are also coming from communities that haven't had a voice. So I'm hoping that we're just the first of many and that we see a whole slew of more of working class people of color who start to run for office.
Well, I'm not sure how much this is totally attributed to you and your fellow freshman classmates in the legislature, but it seems like this is the first legislative session that's accomplished anything in several years. And the first one ever to really accomplish any of the Oregon's climate goals that have just like fizzled in I don't know how many legislative sessions. What do you attribute to the fact that this time the Republicans didn't walk out and leave us hanging and that you were able to get past so many important and progressive legislative acts?
I think there are so many forces that can converge to making this a successful session. I think I can speak for ourselves in shaping the coalition. We were really intentional about wanting to make sure that we did involve Republicans from the beginning, at least in conversations. We had Representative Mark Owens, who represents Eastern Oregon, is very interested in renewable energy. I don't think energy is a bipartisan issue. I think there is support for energy independence, looking at renewable energy and some of the real benefits that the transition to renewable energy can offer, particularly rural communities in terms of jobs and investment. So we, even if he was not able to eventually in the end support it, he was involved from the beginning and was involved in discussions and the policy was shaped by his input, as well as from other partners across the state, including labor, including renewable energy developers. I mean, I do think it's important that we really did build a coalition that was based statewide and really tried to incorporate the concerns. So and that was why we selected this as one of the first issues that we wanted to work on together, just to really take a really sector-based approach as opposed to the economy-wide approach, which past sessions took, which I think led to which might have just been led to having a lot of opposition from many different sectors. So I can't speak to it to begin for sure, but I do know that focused approach and that engagement of a broad coalition was really critical to our success.
Well, it seems like the first achievement you had was to get the Republicans not to walk out, because once you could have a quorum, then there was a strong enough Democratic majority to pass all these. Not everything passed, and we'll get to the things that didn't pass this session. Well, I just wondered how many Republicans actually voted for these bills.
We did have in the Revenue Committee, Representative Greg Smith did vote in support of it. And I think a lot of Republicans privately expressed some support for this. And I think Yeah, like I said, I think energy is a bipartisan issue, and many, many Republicans do see the benefits of that. Their districts are really prime candidates for benefiting from the renewable energy wind farms, the solar farms. There's just a lot of economic development opportunities for Oregon in this bill that Republicans, while recognizing that the rhetoric of climate might be challenging, that's one reason we tried to avoid just purely talking about climate and really emphasizing the jobs and investments and that we would bring to the historically underinvested communities.
So did any Republicans vote in support of the bills?
Like I said, in committee, yes. And on the floor, I think the representative who did vote in support was actually having a surgery that day. So unfortunately, we weren't able to get a bipartisan vote. Yeah, they did vote on other energy bills, like our energy affordability bill, which allows for the PUC to allow utilities to offer discount rates to low-income households. House Bill 2475 did get bipartisan support, as well as Healthy Homes, which is going to invest $10 million for home repairs and weatherization to help low-income Oregonians.
I want to break down all these different bills, as there were several climate bills, and then after that we'll get to some of the other issues that were equally important that also got addressed for the first time in this session. But first, I'm wondering, what was the chief difference between the bills that got passed this time, and it was basically a cap-and-trade bill, if I understand, the last two sessions, that just never could make it, and that really raised the hackles of particularly Eastern Oregon legislators. So what's the difference between the bills that you put forward this year and the ones that floundered in the last two sessions?
So we put forward a suite of three bills that made up the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Bill. The first was energy affordability, which I just mentioned, House Bill 2475. So that allows the PUC to offer discounts to low-income Oregonians on their utility bills. So that way nobody has to decide between, as we have people in the midst of a heat wave having to decide between paying for cooling or paying for heating and paying to put food on the table. The second bill was Healthy Homes House Bill 2842, which it's in this time of the wildfires is just heightening the importance of being able to weatherize homes so people can keep their smoke out, they can harden their homes, they can do energy efficiency upgrades, septic system repairs. This is particularly for low-income Oregonians to help improve resilience in the face of increasing climate disasters. And then the third is the 100% Clean Energy for All Bill, House Bill 2021. And that mandates that the utilities have to go to 100% renewable energy by 2040. And it puts into environmental justice at the center in terms of environmental justice communities being able to partner to make sure that they're helping to shape the utilities' plans and how to get there. And it also includes $50 million in a community-based renewable energy fund so that communities that particularly outside of the Portland metro area that don't often have access to funding for these renewable projects can get community-based projects where the benefits from these projects don't just go to huge utility-scale projects, but also are helping to build, whether it's small microgrids or even renewable-powered cooling centers, which is what we heard from some groups, or smoke shelters. These are the kinds of smaller, decentralized community projects that we need to see more of. And that's also included in House Bill 2021.
Now, I've heard some criticism of this bill from a couple sectors, and I'm not sure it's actual criticism or it's raising fears of what's happened in the past. But there's concerns about how clean energy is defined. And I guess the big player on the table right now in that controversy is Northwest Natural Gas, who is claiming that they are going to renewable natural gas and that should be considered a renewable clean energy. And I'm wondering, how is that controversy being handled right now?
We were fairly technology neutral when it came to the language, is my memory, but I am very skeptical about renewable natural gas. And I am concerned that it is one way that we will lock in our infrastructure around natural gas, and we need to move off of fossil fuel infrastructure as fast as possible. And so I'm committed to making sure that in future discussions, I think where these discussions are going to happen in the next session as well as the coming sessions. And so that's when we're going to have to make some tough decisions about making sure that we're investing in an infrastructure that will last for decades. We can't be extending the the lifeline in building new infrastructure, even if it's potentially cleaner infrastructure that continues to allow for fossil fuel energy development.
But one of the concerns a lot of people raise is that particularly the frack gas industry, and locally it's Northwest Natural Gas, and up in the Puget Sound is Puget Sound Energy, are spending enough money on basically greenwashing frack gas and trying to get people to buy into the importance of building more gas infrastructure. That money that they're spending just on advertising could probably go a long ways in providing renewable energy to many people across the Pacific Northwest. So I'm just curious if you have a sense of how much impact that kind of lobbying is having on the legislature and how you can organize your fellow legislators to stand up against it.
That's the power of being able to have someone on the inside. I think I am able to organize with my fellow legislators like Rep. Pam Marsh, who has been an incredible leader in the House Energy Environment Committee, to get briefings on renewable natural gas to find out. And that's where we can ask questions about the potential stranded costs that can occur when we invest in renewable hydrogen or renewable natural gas. And just to really, really critically examine some of the arguments that the natural gas industry are putting forth. I don't think anybody is oblivious to the fact that, of course, the natural gas industry has a strong self-interest in promoting anything that's going to keep their industry alive, even in the face of increasing climate disasters that are making clear the urgency of taking action now to move completely off of fossil fuels. So I think it's an opportunity for more partnerships with community activists who have been working on these issues for years, and making sure that we have briefings in the interim session now to ensure that legislators are brought up to date. I do believe that in the state of Oregon, though, grassroots organizers still have a lot of opportunities to educate legislators.
Well, I'm wondering what happened to cap and trade, because that was the big push both here and in Washington and in California. It's already been established, and it's also a highly criticized method of dealing with climate change. But I'm wondering, are people still wanting to go forward with cap and trade, or do you think that's a dead issue now?
I have not heard. I think it's a dead issue. I hope it is. I was opposed to the cap and trade bill myself. I think that in this time, we need to take stronger action that's, you know, directly mandating 100% clean and not using price signals and kind of these market-based strategies that we know lead to sacrifice zones where certain communities have to sometimes deal with even stronger emissions because companies can afford to pay for offsets. I'm really troubled by, in these latest wildfires, how many forest carbon offsets have been burned in this hope that we could substitute forest carbon for fossil carbon. And I have not heard conversations about bringing that back.
Well, do you feel like what's happened in this last legislature here in Oregon is like living up to Oregon's environmental sense of itself, you know, going back to the early 70s when we were a leader in things like land use planning and the bottle bill? And it seemed like for many years we were still resting on the laurels from 1973. Do you think we have now created new laurels we can rest on, or do we need to just keep pushing ahead?
We have to keep pushing ahead. Absolutely. This is just the first of many. This is just one sector. We need to look at our building sector and housing. We need to look at our transportation sector, which is arguably the biggest emissions source in the state, as well as forestry. As someone who sits on the revenue committee, I'm definitely interested in looking at how the timber industry is held accountable, both in terms of the taxes they contribute, but as well as the practices that we allow as a state. Agriculture is a huge contributor. I hope that this inspires us and shows what is possible when we have powerful coalitions led by frontline leaders across the state in collaboration with legislators. But this is just the beginning.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Oregon State Representative Con Pham about several bills that passed during Oregon's 2021 legislative session that achieved climate and social justice goals that have eluded previous legislative sessions. Well, why do you think it was that we've had a Democratic majority in both houses for several years now and a supermajority for at least the last two sessions? Why do you think it was so hard to get these bills passed up until this past session?
You know, I wasn't here. I just started in 2020 session, so I'm hesitant to make some. Yeah, I can only speak about my experience with this coalition. And I think that it was very powerful that we started off with with statewide listening sessions, really listening to frontline communities, both in urban areas but also in rural areas, to make sure that the policy solutions that we came up with in this campaign were really grounded in the experiences of communities. And we wanted to make sure that it wouldn't provide disproportionate burdens. And there were some questions in previous bills about the impact that it would have on gas prices for rural communities, and we wanted to make sure that we came up with mechanisms like the energy affordability bill to make sure that there were some there was actual actions to prevent to prevent cost increases, and also enable the lowest income Oregonians to get discount rates.
Well, it seems, too, that there's a difference between having a single climate crisis bill on the table and having this trilogy that you put together. So I wanted to talk about the interface of the social justice issues, the economic issues, and the environmental issues that came together in these three bills. And how was that framed so that it really became effective in getting these bills passed?
Well, I should say, actually, one thing I forgot to mention is that two of these bills we have been fighting for the last two sessions before this, at least the energy affordability bill. We had been pushing a version of that bill for the last two sessions, and they were also similarly stymied by, in part by these unspoken rules that we can only pass one environmental bill per session, which is a bill that we proved wrong. We can't, that in this time of an environmental and climate crisis, we need to be able to both walk and chew gum. We can do multiple environmental bills at the same time. But we have been talking about the need for discount energy rates for many years. So I don't want to imply that this was just the result of, you know, one session and we were able to do it all. And many times people don't see the years and years of work and education that went into passing these bills.
Actually, I just want to follow up on what you just said, because you answered the previous question by saying, well, you can't talk about past sessions because you've only been in the legislature the last session. However, weren't you one of those people on the outside for the last, I don't know how many years, trying to get the legislature to listen to you? And I wonder the difference between being there and what you did out there and how that's influenced what you're able to do now inside the legislature.
Oh, yes. Having me on the inside and having a bunch of other legislators on the inside as well was really game-changing in terms of being able to push a much more transformative agenda. The whole makeup of the body shifted with incoming freshmen, and we just had really powerful voices that were saying, you know, the status quo is not acceptable. So I really appreciated the opportunity to be able to collaborate deeply with outside community groups. Particularly, I'm thinking of the Oregon Just Transition Alliance and Verde and Rogue Climate in Southern Oregon, NAACP Eugene, Adelante Mujeres in Washington County. I mean, there were just so many groups across the state that came together to really push this suite of bills forward. And with connections on the inside now, you know, with somebody who had worked for years with them on the outside, we were able to pass these bills. I guess I'm hesitant to claim credit for all of these because I think the conditions, there were so many conditions from the federal stimulus package and everything, but I do think that inside-outside strategy has been a critical factor.
Well, I remember actually talking to you back when you were running for office, and it was the very beginning of COVID, but before we were locked down. And I actually don't even remember the specific question that I asked you, but it had to do with hoping that there was going to be funding through the COVID bill that was going to pay for basically for housing and for other things that people really needed. And none of that really came through in 2020. I mean, but things seem to have shifted now. And I wonder what differences you see on the national scale that are impacting Oregon between the time you were running for office a year and a half ago and now that you are an elected official.
Oh, I mean, the changes of the federal government transformed what's possible in Oregon. If we didn't have the Biden administration and we didn't have a very slight majority in the House to be able to pass these huge stimulus bills, we wouldn't be able to have made these historic investments in housing. We invested over $500 million in housing, both in affordable housing development as well as property acquisition, so that we can take land off the market and start to keep it permanently affordable for low-income and working-class Oregonians. It really taught me how much I mean, just again, how much elections matter. Both what Stacey Abrams did in Georgia allowed us to have the kinds of results that we, you know, the kinds of historic investments in Oregon that we needed. The ARPA funding was really critical in terms of being, the American Rescue Plan was critical in terms of being able to find the funds that we needed. As a state, we can't run a deficit. We have to balance our budget, and we're still a fairly small state, and so we needed the funds from the federal government to be able to make these critical investments, which historically the federal government has made in housing. Historically, housing has been the realm of public housing has been the realm of the federal government, but over the last few decades, it has continually defunded investments in public housing, and so states have had to step in, like Oregon, to figure out how are we going to provide publicly subsidized housing, because that's one of the biggest crises we're facing as a state, in addition to climate and economic inequality.
Well, actually, while we're talking about this, you might help answer a question that I've raised with my partner about what's happening now that the eviction moratorium is lifted federally. And I kept saying to my partner, well, I think it's okay in Oregon because I think it was extended. So I want to know if I'm right. I wasn't sure if it was extended just to Multnomah County or if it was in the state, but how is Oregon dealing with the fact that the federal eviction moratorium is now no more?
Right now, Oregon, I think Multnomah County did extend it slightly, but Oregon started a landlord compensation fund so that any renters who are having problems can just, well, actually it goes to the landlords because we wanted to make sure, I'm not on the housing committee, but the way that the chair of the housing committee explained it, it's more efficient to make sure that landlords can just get all of their tenants covered who have any challenges paying. For who had during the pandemic, if they had any challenges paying their rent, can then the landlord can apply to get 100% of their costs reimbursed, and we're using federal dollars to ensure that. And so that was hundreds of millions of dollars that we're using to make sure that renters don't have to get evicted. As long as they apply to get through this fund, the landlord can get all of their costs reimbursed. To be honest, this is something that I am looking to still strengthen. I don't sit on the housing committee, but I am I feel like I'm an honorary member of the housing committee that really wants to dig in deeper, because I am worried about this the next few months as we see more and more people start to be impacted.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a concern. It's a really big concern. I've been seeing like lots and lots of headlines about it. And my partner and I have been having lots of kind of desperate conversations about what's going to happen to all these people, as if there aren't already so many homeless people before you start throwing all these people who are housed right now but can't pay their rent out. So I'm just wondering, are people in Oregon overall better off than people around the rest of the country? Or is there still a great bit of insecurity about how soon other people are going to lose their homes?
I mean, Oregon is slightly better, but I don't think, again, we should rest on our laurels. There are still, as you mentioned, we have so many people who are houseless, and I think we do need to come up with better streamlined systems to make sure that we're dispersing this money that the federal government has given to ensure that people stay in their homes. We absolutely need to strengthen our policies, both tenant protections. We need investments we did make some investments in tenant support services and legal support services so that tenants can actually get support with evictions and get representation. So they just have more legal resources at their disposal. But I think there is much more we need to do. And I'm committed as a legislator to working with the Oregon Housing Community Services Agency to make sure that we're streamlining our services, staffing up to make sure that Oregon tenants have the support that they need.
Well, I was just thinking about how, in talking to you right now, I mean, there's a million concerns that progressive-minded and just humanitarian-minded Oregonians have about all the things that are really scary that are going on right now. And I feel like, well, you're the elected official, and you're on the side of really helping people. So, you know, what can you do? And I'm thinking how that's pretty overwhelming thing to lay on your shoulders and on the other progressive legislators in the Oregon legislature. But I do wonder if you feel empowered in some way to be able to address these really critical issues that are leaving the rest of us kind of speechless and really worried.
Yeah, I mean, that's a real thing. I mean, we are a part-time legislator. We're supposed to hold down other jobs as we're doing this job that is truly more than full time. And we entered, you know, when I decided to run for office, this was pre-pandemic, January 2020, right before everything transformed. It was a different world. And I do feel sometimes really sobered, really, yeah, I do sometimes feel self-doubt about just the immensity of the problems that we face. I do, but I just have to, you know, I gain strength and kind of ground myself again when I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like the third natural disaster in like 9 months. I just ground myself in that I'm not doing it alone. I think I am rooted in communities. I come from community organizing and I'm not, I just have to keep reminding myself that I'm not doing this alone. I think I've learned a lot that, you know, I think people sometimes think of government as a monolithic group, not recognizing that, you know, school board members are very different from part-time state legislators who are very different from U.S. Congress people. And we need to, I still strongly believe that we, government is for the people and by the people, and we need to take ownership of it. And we can only do that by electing people who are more rooted in communities and accountable to communities. And so, and that it also what keeps me from feeling overwhelmed, because I'm saying I'm not doing this alone. I'm doing this with help from so many community partners who have expertise in all of these different issues. I can't be an expert in all the issues. And so I'm really depending on partners who have been deeply studying transportation issues or deeply helping tenants and housing and know how to what we need to do on housing. And when it comes to the climate crisis, whether it's energy or disaster resilience, that's how I kind of comfort myself. But I'm just to be real, I feel the same sense of overwhelm sometimes.
Well, I'm thinking about all the different groups that worked, first of all, to get you elected. And I think it was kind of a statewide effort, if I understand. It wasn't just District 46 that was involved, but also the groups that really worked with you and other progressive legislators to get these bills passed. And you mentioned Road Climate before, which is like one of my favorite organizations in the state. And there they are in Jackson County, which used to be one of the most conservative counties in Oregon, which I think is really being transformed. But other groups also from other parts of the state. And I wanted to talk a little bit about, maybe do a shout out to some of these groups, where they're from and how they're transforming not only what's happening in Salem, but what's happening in their communities across the state.
Yeah, I mean, so like I mentioned, Road Climate has been so key. And they, especially when we think about how this Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity campaign is really not just about energy, but is also about disaster resilience. Their office burned down in Talent, and they have been for the last year helping their community recover from last year's wildfires, and their own organization recover. And so they brought so much to the conversations around policy in terms of how can we make sure that this transition to renewable energy isn't just done replicating the kind of energy system that we have now, but just with solar panels. We knew that we needed to, they've been such a great voice in making sure that we decentralize, we democratize our energy system. And I'm deeply grateful for the really principled leadership and grassroots organizing that they've done that has really helped shape this policy to ensure that we're building true community-based disaster resilience while we're also building this decentralized, democratized energy system. We have, I mentioned Las Adelante Mujeres, I don't know, just called Adelante Mujeres, as well as El Valcre, which is based in Hermiston in Ontario. They're doing really powerful organizing in the Latinx community. These are places that, you know, in Eastern Oregon, people don't realize that in places like Hermiston, they're actually a huge part of the population that they make up, I'm really bad at numbers. So I want to say something like, 10 to 20% of the population, and yet have not had representation for the entire time that they've been there. So, you know, it's been incredible to be able to work with them, to hear some of their community leaders' experiences, and make sure that those community leaders are helping to inform our policy, as well as groups along the I-5 corridor in Eugene, Springfield. Beyond Toxics has been incredible, and WCP Eugene, Springfield. We have Verde, of course, Opal, Apano, the Coalition of Communities of Color, I mean, it's been such a incredible coalition of frontline-led organizations who really convened this coalition. Of course, we had support as well from OEC, Climate Solutions, Northwest Energy Coalition, they're called OSEA now, Oregon Solar Energy and Storage Association. But really the leadership and the values that shaped the campaign came from frontline community groups who wanted to make sure that as we think about this transition, this energy transition, we're not just centering the renewable energy part, but we're making sure that we're looking at just energy. What are the impacts of energy on tribal communities, for example, when we think about hydropower even, which everyone thinks of as a purely clean thing, but it has real impacts on salmon, on tribal communities, and we need to be considering all of that. As you were pointing out with renewable natural gas, things are not as simple as industry would want us to believe, and it's important that we take a really intersectional lens as we analyze the impacts of even renewable energy.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Oregon State Representative Khan Pham about several bills that passed during Oregon's 2021 legislative session that achieved climate and social justice goals that have eluded previous legislative sessions. I just want to say, and you're talking about the work that's going on in Eastern Oregon, I drove through La Grande about a month ago and was rather pleasantly surprised to see this huge billboard right in the middle of downtown La Grande that said Black Lives Matter. And it made me think there's some organizing going on in La Grande.
Yeah, that's what we saw from this. First of all, we started a year ago doing a listening session, and it included the Rural Organizing Project. And that was right when so many Black Lives Matter protests were at their strongest last summer. And it was amazing the kind of courage that we heard from rural organizers who were facing off sometimes, you know, armed counter-protesters, but really still felt it important to assert that Black Lives Matter. And that kind of organizing rural frontline communities with urban communities to find our common interests that so many forces that are trying to pit us against each other, are ignoring the fact that, or really are trying to obscure the fact that we face some of the same challenges, or at least have some of the same that it's really corporate interests that are benefiting, and that is a root cause of why there is so much historic disinvestment in rural communities. I realized also, I forgot to mention PECUN, Oregon's Farm Workers Union, which was also so critical in helping to pass these set of bills, bringing forth the voices of Oregon's farm workers to ensure that they also benefit from this energy transition.
Well, a number of these organizations that you mentioned, like PECUN and also like the Rural Organizing Project, have been around for a long time, like over 30 years. And it's makes me think about how long it takes to really build a movement. And I wonder what you think about time and the time it's taken to get as far as we are. How much time do you think is going to take us to get where we need to be? Because we have less than 8 years before, in terms of the climate particularly, things could be just about over if we don't really act on it now.
Yeah, you know, I also sometimes talk about how we only have a decade or less than a decade, but I also think it's important to recognize that ecologically, that's not the way the world works. And I worry that using that frame actually reinforces this sense of doomism that people are like, well, if we don't do this in the next, even, because I mean, I've heard that same thing about by 2021, then we should just give up and there's, you know, game's over and then the world will end. The truth is we're going to always have to fight for our communities. And so I feel a tremendous sense of urgency, which is why I decided to run. I did not feel comfortable running. It's not my comfort zone. I'm naturally a little bit more introverted and not always the person who puts themselves out there. But I felt like I owed it to my daughter. I needed to look my daughter in the eye and say, in this time of climate crisis and vast racial and economic inequality, I needed to do everything I could to ensure that she has a livable planet. And And I think, this time calls for all of us to step up and think about how we're going to contribute, whether it's running for office or whether it's, joining an organization that's doing transformative work. We need to be stepping up because there is a sense of urgency. But I also would we need to figure out how to talk about the urgency without somehow giving people a sense that if we cross this one deadline, then it's all over.
Well, we talked a little bit earlier about the intersectionality of the different issues that all wound up having bills passed to deal with them. And so I wanted to get into some of the other issues that some people might wonder, why are you talking about this on an environmental show? But a couple of the other things that were certainly critical in this past legislative session were dealing with police accountability and criminal justice reform. So I wanted to talk about the measures that got passed there and how you see them maybe making some important changes in both a police accountability and our criminal justice system.
Yeah, we passed some incredible, the legislature passed 22 police accountability bills this session, thanks largely to the leadership of Rep. Janelle Bynum and all the members of the House Judiciary Committee. One important bill we passed was SB 621, the police arbitration bill, which is going to allow Portland to implement our new police oversight board that voters overwhelmingly passed last election. So, I have to say, sadly, though, there was another bill I was really excited about, House Bill 2002, the Justice Reinvestment Act, which would have basically reduced some of the interactions between police and also transform or reform some of the Measure 11 mandatory minimums. And that did not pass this session, even though it was a very strong community-led effort to basically reimagine our criminal justice system.
So why did that not pass, do you think?
I don't know. It didn't. I know that there was significant opposition from the police, and prosecutors. I don't know why we weren't as powerful enough to overcome it, though. It happened in committee. I'm not on the committee, so it happened mostly in the Judiciary Committee.
I'm curious if Mike Schmidt, our local district attorney in Multnomah County, what his position was on that, because he's certainly about the most progressive district attorney we've had in this area for a long time. And it's come under fire. But I'm just wondering I wonder if he's any kind of ally when you're trying to pass police accountability bills in Salem.
I think he has a bully pulpit he can talk about, and he can at least express his strong support. He's been a strong supporter and he's been very aligned, but I don't know how much he can transform some of the other opposition. I will say that even though the Justice Reinvestment Act itself didn't pass, key components of House Bill 2002 were incorporated into other bills that were passed this session. So we did pass a separate bill, SB 620, that's going to eliminate supervision fees for people who are in community corrections programs who often leave prison with very little resources to make these payments. And we shouldn't make them pay us in order to be under probation. Also, House Bill 2204, which sets up a restorative justice grant program for $4 million through the Criminal Justice Commission. And that is really key to not just stopping the bad that we see in our current criminal justice system, but also starting to build the new system that we want.
Well, I'm wondering, what were some of the biggest disappointments this session? Because there were some really good bills that didn't make it. And I did a show actually in March about a bill that people were trying to get passed that would ban trapping beaver on public lands. And that didn't get out of committee. And I mean, that was one of many. So I'm just curious about what were some of your maybe pet legislation that didn't get out of committee or got voted down, and why you think they didn't pass.
Well, I'm really disappointed that the farm worker overtime bill, House Bill 2358, didn't pass. Farm workers have been the frontline workers feeding all of our families in this pandemic. And yet they, because of racism, they are excluded from our federal overtime laws. And so they don't get any overtime pay, even if they're working 60, 80 hours a week. And we need to make sure that all workers are treated fairly and have access to overtime pay. So I'm really committed to looking at this short session and trying to make sure that's a top priority in our short session in 2022.
Also, weren't there some climate issues that didn't get passed as well?
Yeah, we did have a bill that would have put equity and climate justice in our planning goals, and that didn't pass. That was really disappointing. We did pass an environmental justice framework, though, which just asserts that we are going to center environmental justice in all of our decision making.
It kind of reminds me of the Gorge Commission, Scenic Commission, passed their sweeping changes in their mission. And it was the same thing where people were trying to get them to incorporate equity and climate into their decision making and every decision that's made. And they basically created a framework to talk about it. So how do we get beyond these frameworks to actually get the actual meat into legislation so that that equity becomes something that is an integral part of every facet of lawmaking?
I mean, we have to just pass legislation that really centers that, and I'm really committed to making sure that that's a priority. I agree. The framework is a first step. It's a stepping stone so that we can actually use it to refer back to in future policies. We think we all agreed on this. These are our values as a state. And so therefore it justifies why we're centering that in whatever bill we have, whether it's environmental or criminal justice or housing related. The other thing I did mention that is climate related is our indirect sources bill, House Bill 2814, which was going to regulate air pollution that is from indirect sources, often like construction or parking lots, things that are not direct, you know, trucking diesel trucks, but often have been some of the biggest emitters. That didn't pass, and it was just going to be even a study bill. I mean, it was going to be a real regulation bill. It was got downgraded to a study bill, and even that didn't pass. And I'm really disappointed in that. I'm really committed to working with Representative Dexter, Maxine Dexter, and pushing that forward, as well as the bill, House Bill 2357, to reform the Oregon Forest Resources Institute. It did pass the House, but it didn't come up for a vote in the Senate.
Yeah, that was actually something very disappointing, and something that we're going to be talking a lot more about on this show, because it's very critical, and it's an organization or it's an agency that very few people actually even know about.
We're committed to working on that. I think the fact that, yeah, I could tell through our vote on the Harvest Tax, I think it's clear that looking at OFRI is, in a more transformative way, I think there will definitely be tremendous transformation of OFRI in the coming years.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Oregon State Representative Khan Pham about several bills that passed during Oregon's 2021 legislative session that achieved climate and social justice goals that have eluded previous legislative sessions. One thing we haven't talked about yet, which was on your list of achievements in one of the emails that you sent out, was ensuring equity and economic recovery. Was that something that actually is incorporated in some of the bills that passed, or is that still something that you're working towards?
Absolutely. It was in, I think it's part of all of our bills, and also not just the policy bills, but in our funding investments, which I think I would argue is where you can see our values put into play, where we're putting our money. So we did make some critical investments in childcare, to make sure that we were streamlining Oregon's public child care services right now, because we know that in order for workers to get to have some level of to get back into the economy, but also in a way that helps their families, that we need to improve access to Oregon's child care systems. Almost all counties in Oregon are child care deserts, and we know that women of color in particular are particularly hurt by lack of access to child care, which impacts their ability to find work and be able to take care of their families. So I'm really proud of the work that we did to improve access to childcare, as well as some of the work that I did in the Revenue Committee to pass an expansion of the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is a huge poverty-fighting tool to help our lowest-income Oregonians access the tax credit dollars to ensure that they can, they can pay for needed repairs on their car or just pay for emergencies that happen. Right now, ITIN filers are people with an individual tax identification number instead of a Social Security number can have access to this tax credit.
It has a little bit technical. So what does that actually mean?
So not everybody in Oregon has a Social Security number, and you need that to have access to the federal earned income tax credit. Basically, every year when you file your taxes, if you make under a certain income threshold, then you can qualify for the earned income tax credit, and that has enabled working class and working poor families to be able to get. Often, it's up to $500, $1,000, up to $3,000 sometimes to be able to pay for needed needed expenses. And so right now, so many Oregonians who are working and pay taxes, they aren't eligible because they don't have a Social Security number. So this bill, that it wasn't a bill, we actually put it as part of an omnibus tax credit bill. It allows Oregonians with ITIN numbers to be able to individual tax identification numbers to be able to have access to the earned income tax credit.
So what are your hopes and plans for, you talked about a short session that's coming up, not to mention the next session. Actually, the next session could be a possibly different legislature because it would be in 2023. But what would you like to see happen in the next year?
In 2022?
Yeah. This year in 2022. This short session would be in 2022? Is that, or is Kate Brown, she's not planning on having another session this summer unless we have another crisis.
We will have a special session in September for redistricting, to pass redistricting. And we may have other special sessions called if there's other crises that come up. I'm hoping that we use this interim period to really deepen our relationships. Particularly, I'm really looking at, I'm right now interviewing and trying to bring together other community groups for informal discussions and strategizing about what we want to do, because the success of the short session in 2022 depends on the preparation that we do now to make sure that we have the boldest and most transformative climate, environmental, and economic and racial justice agenda that's possible. And I'm looking in 2022, particularly at the transportation sector. I think that transportation is our biggest source of emissions. We've seen, as now people are going back to their cars, many people are not going back to public transit, and we need to build more active, walkable communities and transportation systems so that we can get people out of their cars and into public transit and onto their bikes.
Well, I had a conversation with some friends a couple weeks ago about getting places and the concern that nobody's going on buses because of COVID. I mean, there are people, but I look at the bus that goes by my house and very rarely see any people in it. And it's a concern, but then I'm thinking, I'm not going on the bus either because I don't really feel comfortable doing it. So how do we, now with the Delta variant, of course, is even more unknown. So I'm just wondering, how do we transition people safely back to public transit and make them feel comfortable riding it while we still have a pandemic going on?
Well, that's why all of these issues are interconnected. We need to have the strongest COVID pandemic response possible. And that's why I've been really pushing for, to make sure that we allow healthcare employers to require that their employees get vaccinated. I'm a strong supporter of keeping masks on, even in public schools and indoors. And because I'm not a healthcare expert, but I do support the analyses of my fellow colleagues who are doctors, who are saying this Delta variant is very serious and we need to take the strongest, we need to have the strongest COVID response possible. So all these issues are so interconnected. For transit, like I said, if we can get the numbers down, that will make transit safer. And we need to, that's what I'm really having conversations with partners. How do we ensure that not just choice riders, but also transit-dependent riders who don't have a choice have a transportation system that works for them, that is safe. And it could, maybe we need to look at making sure all the windows are completely open and so that there's a lot of airflow. And we do have mask mandates existing, but I think that with increased frequency and better service, we can get people back into public transit safely. And so I'm really looking to our partners to figure out how we can do that.
Yeah, actually, I'm hoping they're going to return the bus over the Selwood Bridge again, which hasn't been running since the Selwood Bridge was replaced. But it's, I think, one of many examples where TriMet just doesn't go where it really needs to go. But that's not the state. That's not the legislator's role. I mean, I'm not sure if there's ways you can encourage local transit or agencies to actually do the right thing.
Well, I think we can at least use use our platforms to be able to lift up the need for better transit. And like I said, not everyone has a choice. There are still frontline workers who have to ride the bus, and they need to have service that is frequent and goes the hours and goes the places that they need. And that's the only way that we're going to survive in this. And this, as we move off of fossil fuels, we can't just replicate this single car culture. We need to build communities where people can easily ride buses that are flying through their rose, what's it called? The rose lanes, while people are stuck in their cars, because we need to prioritize and incentivize public transit.
Yeah, well, we have another conversation sometime about the whole issue about freeways and, you know, why we don't need to build more freeways, why we need to really concentrate on public transit. But that'll be a different conversation later on. And I'd be interested to have
that
in partnership with some local activists. So we could talk about that some other
time.
I want to say one
last... I look to my community partners.
Yes. And I want to just say one last thing, Khan. I got a comment on the Facebook posting I did for this show from a friend of mine who said he is really happy that you've been elected to the legislature. And I think there's a lot of people that feel that way. So I just want to get a sense from you of what you feel is your obligations now to all those people who got you elected, who feel like you're a voice for them.
So what's my obligation?
Maybe the obligation is the wrong word, but how do you feel about knowing that there's people who really see you as a very important voice for them in the state legislature?
I see. I feel a mix of so many emotions. I've actually been thinking about that when watching Simone Biles and, you know, just the courage that she had. when people put so many hopes and dreams into somebody who's doing something in the public eye, not that I'm anywhere near that Olympic athlete, but there is, you know, pressure when it comes to being in the public spotlight, and people put a lot of hopes and dreams. And I feel very honored. I put a lot of pressure myself. I really feel like I do see how many hopes people have for transformative change through electing me and others, and I want to make sure that I honor the sacrifices and all the hard work that volunteers put into helping to make sure that I was elected by working as hard as I can to put forth the people's agenda. But again, like, I just keep reminding myself, I'm not doing this alone. That this is, I happen to be the face and playing this one role at this particular time. But as an organizer, I hope that I'm also seeding new leadership opportunities for others to come up and also do the same thing. And so it's, you know, in the last 20 years I've been in the movement, I've played many different roles, and this is just the latest. And we need all different kinds of people to play all different kinds of roles in this movement, because I believe we need to change everything if we want to survive. And so I mostly just remind myself, yes, it's a huge responsibility, and I'm not alone.
Well, Khan, we're very glad you're there, and I'm really happy to be talking to you today, and I hope to talk to you again in the not-too-distant future. So thanks for being on Locus Focus.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we've been talking with Oregon State Representative Khan Pham, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KWU Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping us all volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage, or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. I want to thank my engineer, Ray, who has been doing an excellent job here at KWU for the last 2 weeks engineering this show, and I'm really happy. He's the only person in the station with me, and it's really nice to share the space. So thank you, Ray. Next week, we'll talk with Vivek Chandez about social justice implications of hotspots around Portland as the climate continues to warm. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with some music by Hugh Masekela. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.
I wanna be there when the people start to turn it around, when they triumph over poverty. I wanna be there when the people win the battle against AIDS. I wanna lend a hand. I wanna be there for the alcoholic. I wanna be there for the drug addict. I wanna be there for the victims of violence and abuse. I wanna lend a hand. Send me to Mami Na.
To
Mami Na.
To Mami Na.
City.